This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs, featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. I'm Joan Neuberger, editor of Not Even Past, and your host for many of these episodes of 15 Minute History. Did you know that everyone who makes these podcasts is a volunteer? All the historians who have the interesting conversations you like to listen to while you drive or run or make dinner or just go about your day, squeeze out some time from their busy, busy schedules to come into the studio and talk to us. We know you like what you hear, so today we're asking you to help support us with a donation if you can. These podcasts will always be yours for free, but they're not free to make. So if you can help support the history you love, please go to 15minutehistory.org and click our donate button. That's the numbers 15minutehistory.org. And now on to today's episode. Today we're making another exception for an exceptional interview. Last spring we spoke with Heather Williams, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, about her research on the ways enslaved people in the United States were routinely separated from their families. Professor Williams was willing to speak with us for much more than our usual 15 minutes, and we've decided to share the entire conversation with you. So, welcome to today's episode of 50 Minute History. Today we're speaking with a guest to the University of Texas at Austin, Professor Heather Williams, who is a professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And she's visiting UT Austin to give our annual Littlefield Lectures in U.S. Southern History. Welcome to 15 Minute History.
Thank you. Thanks, Joel.
Our topic today is going to be the family in slavery, and in particular, the emotional toll it took when slave owners divided up families. So could we start by talking about the family itself? How did families form in slave communities? Were there restrictions? What can you tell us about that?
Sure. There were lots of restrictions. And I mean, just so we understand, slavery meant that people were owned by other people. And the people who owned them had incredible power over them. And so, for instance, there was never any legal right for enslaved people to marry. They could not form a legal bond. There was therefore no legal divorce. However, people got together and formed relationships that they considered marriage. And that happened through a number of means. Sometimes two people would be attracted to each other and they would then have to go to their owner or owners to get permission to marry. So many marriages, many of these relationships happened across plantations or properties so that the woman might be owned by one person and the man owned by somebody else. And so the man would have to go to his owner to ask permission, and then he'd have to go to her owner to ask permission. And so these adult people had to go to other people to get permission to get married. And if they lived on different plantations, the owners would agree on when the man could go to visit his wife and then later possibly their children as well. And typically you see in the sources that on Wednesdays, that was the day on which people were expected to do this kind of movement, and then possibly on Sundays. Other relationships came about because owners forced people together. Really important. Early in the 1600s in Virginia and then in subsequent colonies and states, laws established the fact that children would belong to the owner of the mother. So instead of the way it would have been in England, where it would have been determined by paternity, here it was determined through the mother. So when a man from one plantation was with a woman from another plantation, there was no confusion about who then owned the offspring. So slave owners encouraged people to get together and sometimes forced people to get together and would choose someone. There's testimony by women who say, as a young girl, I was put into a room with this man and I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand what was supposed to happen. And so when he came towards me, I just kind of fought him off. And then eventually the owner said, no, you have to be with him. And so there were those kinds of forced interactions, but there were also consensual, loving interactions.
So was childbearing encouraged or discouraged or?
Childbearing was very much encouraged because you're reproducing property. So I own this woman, and if she has 10 children, now I own 11 people. It was very much encouraged. And on some, certainly on the bigger plantations, you would see that a woman who was pregnant might have some extra latitude. So if she said she was feeling sick, maybe she wouldn't have to work, or maybe she wouldn't be expected to work for a couple of weeks after the child was born. So they really encouraged it, and they wanted the woman to have healthy children. So overworking the woman at that stage would not have been wise. But still, that happens sometimes because people think in the short term, you know, I need this crop brought in, or I need this clothing made. Maybe a woman would be overworked and would miscarry and that kind of thing.
Did religion play much of a role in life cycle events like marriage ceremonies or childbearing?
Well, after, I would say by the mid 1800s, maybe early 1800s, many enslaved people became Christians. So at first they kind of resisted it. Many of them at that point were still coming from Africa. And so the kind of spiritual practices that they had brought with them. But with the Great Awakening, there was more exposure to Christianity and more sort of acceptance of it. And the idea that you could have this relationship with Christ, that you could even become an evangelist and become a preacher. And it kind of, I think for some people, created a space within slavery, a space of relative freedom, that you could think about a place where after this life was over, you'd be free. I've seen cases in which a woman, for instance, said, I wanted to get married to this man, but I kept holding out because I wanted a minister of the gospel to marry us. But there was no minister available. And so she said, eventually, a black man who was kind of a vendor, you know, moving around the landscape, showed up and he performed the ceremony. And one of the things that many former slaves complained about was the fact that during their wedding ceremonies, nobody ever said those words from the traditional marriage vows that what God has put together, let no man put asunder. And that was a clear indication to them that their marriages were not legal and that the owners didn't see them as sanctioned by God. I've seen marriage vows that one owner said he used when he performed the wedding ceremony. And when you read it, he doesn't mention God anywhere. He says, I am gathered here with these people. And he goes through the whole ceremony and he never mentions God. And so they said, you know, we don't get that kind of religious blessing. And there's no observance of the protections that a religious blessing would give us, so that our earthly master substitutes himself for the heavenly master. Mm-hmm. So religion, I think, played out in that sense, that people didn't get the protections that religion might have provided for them.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk about separating families, were there other ways that owners interfered in family life?
Yeah, well, I think putting people together was the big thing. Having the right to say, yes, you can get married or not. Owners called it a broad marriage. So if you lived on separate plantations, even though they might just be some miles apart, you know, we think of abroad as out of the country, but they called it a broad marriages. And they really frowned on it because it reduced their control. You have a man from another plantation coming onto your property, and some of the owners would write about this. He's sitting around and he's off from work. And then your people, your slaves, are watching this and he's setting a bad example. So interference in that way. I think also one of the places where you see conflict is that owners expected obedience from all the people they owned, women, men, children. Parents expected obedience from their children. And so you see that kind of conflict where a father would say to a child, yes, I know Master called you, but I called you at the same time and you have to come to me. But they're walking this tightrope because you want to protect your child. So if the child doesn't respond to the owner or to the overseer or to the mistress or whoever, whichever person in power, that child might be in jeopardy. But the parent also wanted to establish some sense of power, to have some power over somebody, right? And so you see those kinds of conflicts where children had to make decisions and figure out how to navigate this kind of a system in which the normal sort of family strictures were not being abided to because there was somebody else who had more authority than the people who normally would in a family.
You've written now about separation of families, of children from parents and spouses from each other. What kinds of events led to separation of family members?
Lots of events. Again, thinking about slavery as a property relationship. Owners owned, so they owned land and they owned people. And that's where their wealth lay. And it was much easier to get funds from the sale of a person than from selling some real estate. So you might have 1,000 acres, harder to carve it up, just harder to move that property. But if you were in debt, if you owed money, you could sell 10 people or 12 people or 5 people. And so sale was one of the big ways, and often around debt. Mortgages. Enslaved people could be used for a mortgage. You could go and get a loan from a bank and your collateral could be in people. And so if you fail to make the payment, then the bank could come and seize those people. Just like today, they could come and seize your car, for instance. And so that was another way in which people were separated. Quite often, starting in about the 1820s, you see a great migration from the Upper South, so places like North Carolina, Maryland, Virginia, where tobacco cultivation had been the big cash crop, and many enslaved people worked those tobacco fields. Well, tobacco fields started drying up. You can only plant tobacco for about 3 years, and then the nutrients in the soil get used up, and the land has to just lie fallow or idle for 20 years. So you have a lot of expansion, but just lots of land that you can't use. And so then you see this increase in cotton cultivation farther south, and people moving from the Upper South to the Lower South, to places like Alabama, Mississippi, Texas. White family, the slave owners moving from Virginia to Alabama or to Mississippi and taking enslaved people with them to now set up new plantations, new properties that would produce cotton.
And they would take parts of families.
They would wouldn't break up families. Mm-hmm. So they might decide to take 100 of the slaves, not the other 100 or the other 50. And often those decisions would be based on age, so that you might want strong men in their 20s and women in their 20s, but you might not want 6-year-olds. And so that would be a way to separate. But also husbands and wives, they just decided on who they thought would do the best work and who they wanted in that place. And so that would separate people. Also, the marriage of the children of slave owners, that was another time when you had separation, because an owner might own 100 people and give 15 of them to his daughter who got married, and she and her husband are moving to a new place. And those divisions would not necessarily be made in family grouping. Sometimes they were. So not everybody experienced separation. Not every slave experienced separation. But that was not foremost in owners' minds. The death of an owner. When an owner died, slaves knew that there could be serious problems, because now the person in charge is gone. What's going to happen to the people? Everybody might be sold, and that happened often. But through a will, people might be distributed to several members of the family. So the sons come in, they make a claim, and they divide people up by their value. And so again, if you're a prime male hand, and that was the language that they used, a prime hand, let's say between ages 17 and 26, you're worth more than a 14-year-old or a 60-year-old. And so that's how they would balance things out, so that each heir would get a balanced proportion according to what the will had established. And that meant sometimes you get to go with your mother and sometimes you don't. Sometimes the family goes and sometimes not. So I think those are some of the major ways in which separations happen. But I've also seen cases where, for instance, a male cousin of the owner had children with an enslaved woman. And the family, the owner's family, was very embarrassed by this. And so then sold the mother and the children away so that they wouldn't have to always see that. Or a husband, the owner, may have children with an enslaved woman. And the wife is livid and just upset. And to make things easier at home, he would sell those people. And in one particular case I'm thinking about with the cousin, the mother was sold with her two children, a boy and a girl. So they were sold together and they were together for a while, but then they were broken up through another sale. And things could happen at the whim of somebody, often debt. So it's about economics in most instances, because that's what this was about, property. And you had the right as an owner to use your property as you saw fit, to sell your property as you saw fit.
So from the owner's point of view, this was a transaction, an economic transaction. You've written very movingly about the emotional toll that this took on children and parents and family members. Could you talk about some of the children that you have discovered their feelings?
So the sources I have are from adults who recall what their experiences were like as children. And, oh gosh, they remember becoming aware that something was happening. And I think that was really important for me, because you think, you know, children are eavesdropping in families sometimes. You're looking around the corner, you're hearing adult conversations. They start to hear that there's more tension in the home or in the slave community, the slave quarters. And people are upset. So, for instance, when an owner died, there was this increased level of anxiety, and children started to realize, first of all, they're realizing for the first time sometimes that they were slaves, that had some meaning, and that they could be sold. And so the adults would be trying to figure out who's going to go with whom, what's going to happen. And then the day of the sale comes, or the day of the division of property for the heirs. And people describe just really powerful scenes of pain and anguish as a mother is crying for her children and wishing, you know, begging, pleading that the purchaser purchase her, somebody who's buying one of her children, take her with them, or running after the cart as the children are being taken away. And very often, the younger children, they've just become aware that they could be sold. They don't really know what that means. They don't know what separation means. They don't know what it implies. And so they're just kind of going along, you know. And I see children who got into the carriage with other children, and the driver gives them candy, or somebody's purchasing several children and has an old woman, an enslaved woman. So they've purchased a woman who's going to take care of these children. And so the children are quite fine. And it's when the carriage pulls out and the mother is crying and screaming, or days later, when they get to this new environment, their mother's not there. There's nothing familiar. And they start to realize, oh, something awful has happened. And so you really see the changing circumstances and their this kind of cloud parting, and they're starting to realize and becoming aware of what their circumstances were. In some cases, somebody took them in the slave community. So there might be this woman. There's one instance where somebody describes being in the carriage and the woman goes, but there's never any sense that she was a caring, loving person. And you can imagine she had been taken away from her own family. So this is a job for her. Other cases, somebody on the plantation, a woman, sometimes a man, took a child and said, I'll take care of you. And so somebody talks about, you know, this man I think, had been sold along with him and other people from that plantation. The man knew his father and so had promised this boy's father that he would take care of the child. And the man was a musician, and so he would take the child with him at night when he was performing. And so some of them, you get this sense that somebody cared about them, somebody took care of them. Others were, especially on the large plantations, just sort of maybe living in a slave cabin with another family, not necessarily taken in. And so it's hard sometimes to get at the nitty gritty of their daily lives, but you get the sense that it was very, very varied. And so some continued to have a sense of love and caring, even though they had lost the central people in their lives. And then other people you can sense were just kind of managing and trying to figure out what was going on and trying to blend in.
Mm-hmm. And do you have sources that describe the parents' experience of losing their children?
Yeah, a lot of that comes through the children, but also through the people who experienced the loss. Also descriptions from people who observed the loss taking place. And so just really powerful stories about, for instance, a woman who was being taken with a big group of slaves south. And they call that a coffle. And so the men generally would be, men and boys would be chained together. Sometimes the women were not chained and the younger children, but they're part of this coffle. And this was quite familiar.
When you say they were chained together, were they in a carriage or were they chained as they were walking?
No, they're walking.
They're walking.
Yeah. And so there, you can go to the museums in Charleston, for instance, and you can see these chains that were manufactured and produced to hold people around the neck and connect them in that way, or the legs, you know. So just as you would see prisoners being transported in a jail sometimes, in a prison. So they're chained together so that they can't run away. In one case that I'm thinking about, someone wrote about a mother, young mother of an infant, and on the coffle. So they're going to a slave market, but somebody could stop and purchase people at any point, which again relates to separation.
Yeah.
You don't know where the person went to. And the purchaser did not want the infant. And so according to this person who said she observed it, the slave trader took the baby aside and just killed the baby. Apparently the mother kind of lost her mind. So some people were able to survive it emotionally and physically. Some people fell apart. And so to have any vision of people just being always strong and always resilient is not an accurate vision. Many people were resilient and kept on going, but other people just couldn't stop crying. There's a woman who said, "They took my baby away, and sometimes I can hear my son calling me. And he says, 'Mommy, take me with you, take me with you.'" She says, "I put my fingers in my ears because I don't want to hear him." And this was years after she had lost the child. And she said, "I just keep hearing him saying, 'Mommy, take me with you, take me with you.'" And so people just haunted by these losses and by this lack of control. So when I talked about the children of the cousin, so the owner's cousin, and the mother and her two children were sold apart, at some point, the mother sent a message to her son. Basically, she knew a man, another enslaved person, who was going into town, and that's where she had last seen her son. And she wrapped up some beads, just blue beads, in a piece of cloth and sent it and said, "If you find my son, give him these. He'll know what to do." And so once the son opened it, he realized, oh, this really is from my mother. And so he had been teaching himself how to read and write. And he said, "I'd always wanted to be able to write in case I could run away," because you needed to have a pass, a piece of paper with writing on it that said you have permission to move about. Because if you were Black, you were assumed to be a slave and you needed permission. And so he went and he found his mother. And she said, "Once I found out where you were, I tried to escape, but I got beaten and I can't do it anymore." Because he took paper and pen with him to write a pass for her to escape. And she said, "I just can't do it anymore." her owner caught him and he was beaten and then he was sent back to his proper owner. And so you've got all kinds of stories of really a wide range of experiences and parents just talking for years about their children and trying to figure out where they were, searching for them, getting somebody to write a letter back to where they had left the child to try to find some trace of the child.
Listening to you today talk about these experiences is really incredibly painful to think about, just to listen to you talk about them. Were there any slave owners who had any appreciation of, or how did they explain people's feelings? They stood there and watched as mothers, you know, screamed after their children. How did they justify this? Or did they just simply not understand what was going on? What did they think was going on?
Yeah, as far as I can figure out, and this is a question that I took into the research because I was aware they're there, they're present.
They're doing it.
What do you think?
Creating this incredible language.
And I can't account for everybody, but most of them didn't ever say anything about it. So, for instance, there's a letter from a slave trader named Obadiah Fields, and he was on the road selling people and conducting business. He wrote a letter back to his wife. He's headed south. She was in Virginia or Maryland. I don't remember. And at the top of the page, the first half of the letter, he's kind of telling her business information. So I have sold most of the slaves. The ones that I have left are, and he actually named the people. So about six people. And he put information about the ones he had sold and how much he had sold them for. And then something about buying a carriage and that kind of thing. Then at the bottom of the page, he turned to more personal matters. And he expressed his deep love for his wife and his children. And he sent his love to them. You know, you could tell he really cared about them and loved his wife. And he said, I'm sending you, I don't know, $20 to buy a new dress for yourself. And I hope that I'll be back home at Christmas, in time for Christmas. And I love you. And he named his children. I love them. And so in that document, you see this division, you know, so he was selling people who inevitably were being separated from somebody, right? Unless they had already lost everybody. And this was a second or third sale. They're at least being separated from the people they knew. But he never expressed any concern for them. But at the bottom, you see him as a loving person. He was not just some brute. Mm-hmm. You know, he loved his family. And in his short absence from his family, he was missing them and hoping he'd get back. But it's a short absence, and it's an absence that he undertook because it's business. And so there you see, this is a person, this is a human, this is somebody who has feelings, but he's not spending any of those feelings on these other people. I found.
Or even appreciating their situation.
Exactly. He's not saying, oh, they seem so sad when I sell them, or the ones that are left just seem demoralized. Nothing, no acknowledgement at all of them as being other than property. Mm-hmm. He's eager to sell the rest of them because the faster he sells them, the sooner he can get back to his family. Thomas Chaplin, I think, is the slave owner who presents the most complete, complex situation that I have come across. He was a slave owner in South Carolina, well, on St. Helena's Island off the coast of South Carolina. At age 17, he inherited slaves and real estate property from his father. And so he was a young man, became a slave owner, got married. And at the time that I pick him up in 1845, he owned 70 people, but he was in debt. And as I said, debt means people will be sold very often. And so the sheriff was going to come and take possession of some of his slaves to sell them to pay his debts. And he decided that instead of doing that, he would sneak some people off the island and send them to the Charleston market to be sold so that he could make money from their sale and pay the debts and hopefully have some money left over. He'd be able to set a price for them. And in his journal, he wrote, some of his feelings about doing this. And so in one sentence, he says, it's a really terrible thing. It's an awful thing for me to have to sell some of these people. And it's no fault of their own. And you don't know where they'll end up. And separating families, mothers from children. I mean, it's as though he's writing my book, you know, separating mothers from their children, fathers from their children.
He understands that that's painful.
He understands very much that it's painful. It's going to hurt. But he says, but I hope that they'll bring a good price in the market and that I won't have to do this again. And in the journal, as you trace his steps, you can see that he's kind of hiding from the people. He names in the journal the 10 people he's decided to sell. And he brings somebody else in and sends that person down to the slave quarters to pull out those people and take them to the boat to take them to the mainland. He didn't go. He didn't go and face them. And then as they're getting on the boat, he's somewhere looking at them, but he's not down at the strip. I've actually been to the house that he lived in, and you can almost imagine him peeking through the window. You know, the curtains are there, and he had a view, but he didn't want to be there. And then a few days later, he said, he wrote in the journal that the people who were left behind, the families, were disconsolate. So they were just sad. They could not be consoled about the loss of these people. And he says, but it will soon blow over. Maybe they'll see their children again. And then he says something more about money and getting the money and hopefully being satisfied. And as you go through the journal, you see messages coming back saying that these three have been sold, and then this one has been sold, and you don't see any more word about the other three. So they are in Charleston, thriving market in Charleston, and being taken probably to a rice plantation or a cotton plantation, but you just don't know. So here with Chaplin, you see somebody who in some sense is struggling very much with this idea of selling people, but he's also struggling with his loss of mastery. He's not fully in charge of his situation. He shouldn't be in this kind of position. And you see him going back and forth like that. And some people are skeptical of the ideas that he wrote at that point, his expressions of concern about the slaves. But when I go to his original journal, which is in the archives in Charleston, you see that it's handwritten. He wrote these words in 1845. And then after the Civil War ended, and he went back through the journal and annotated certain entries. And for those days in 1845, he wrote, "If only I had known that the Negroes would be so ungrateful as to leave after the war, I would have, and many of us would have, put them in our pockets in the first place. Wouldn't have been concerned about their feelings." And so here he's saying, Civil War, all the slave owners, all the white people from St. Helena fled the island when the Union soldiers were within miles of the place. He turned to one of his slaves and said, "Take care of the place for me." Well, when he came back after the war, they were all gone. Nobody stuck around. They're now free. What are they waiting for, right? And so he was resentful of that. And he says, "If I had known that they would not be loyal to me, I wouldn't have wasted my time in 1845 feeling sorry that I was selling them. I would have put them in my pocket," meaning I would have sold them. I would have cashed them out and had that cash to put in my pocket. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that says the feelings of remorse that he expressed earlier were true feelings, and that now he was regretting those feelings, but that he had had those feelings. And so all of those pieces kind of come together, because I'm trying to figure out who these people are, who the enslaved people are, what are they thinking, and who somebody like Chaplin was, and what he was thinking. And, you know, it can be complicated. And so sometimes people want to say, well, they were just terrible people. But here with Obadiah Fields,
it's more complicated.
More complicated. They're people who had feelings. And in his case, which really is an extraordinary case, I have not come across somebody else like that. You know, Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, was the third president, but also a big slaveholder in Virginia, wrote, the Negroes are not like us. They're not as intelligent as us. They can't write real poetry. They don't feel deeply. Their griefs are fleeting. Their griefs are transient, is what he said, but it doesn't last long. So he's saying they don't feel deeply. But in a letter when he was president, he wrote back to the overseer at the plantation and said one of his slaves who had been accused of, I think, killing somebody, another slave. And he said, if they don't lock him up, then I want you to sell him to Georgia, because nothing is more painful to those slaves as being separated from their families. So he knows the pain. He knows that they'll grieve. But in a big tome that he was sending to the world, he says, oh, but they don't feel deeply. The things that make white people suffer, oh, it just washes right over them. So,
yeah,
you've got all kinds
of
contradictions.
People are full of contradictions.
Yes,
right.
Yes, yes.
You started this project when you've discovered a whole large number of people searching for their family members they've been separated from, and they put ads in newspapers?
Yes, yes. So that's what got me started on the project, because I was doing research and looking through black newspapers in the South and starting in 1865, and I kept coming across these ads. And, you know, you go through the paper and it's just like today. You have a section that's news, maybe editorials, and then you get to a page with ads, and, you know, they're advertising hoop skirts and tobacco and all kinds of miracle medicines, right? And then you see these ads and they're just really powerful and poignant. People looking for family members whom they had lost decades earlier. And they tell you as much information as they had. So her name was Betty, and we were sold by Colonel so-and-so from Virginia, and I was taken here. And very often, they named their owners, they named the traders, because they knew that those were more powerful people than they were. And so somebody might remember that Colonel Johnson's people went to New Orleans or went to Savannah. And so they're hoping that you'll recognize their name, the name of the family members they're looking for, and the names of the people who had sold them or had somehow been involved in the slave trade. Many of them were in a newspaper called the Christian Recorder, which is from the African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME Church. And especially in those, but in some of the others, there'd be a note that said, ministers of the church, please read this aloud. Because in that way, even if only one newspaper came into a community, or if only a few people were literate enough to read an ad, if you read it aloud in church, maybe 100 people would hear it. And then those people would leave and would talk to other people. And so they're calling on the mechanisms within their communities to get the word out. They didn't have the kind of facilities that we have, right? It's not the internet.
It's not that different than holding up a picture on the internet.
Yeah, right.
Saying, help me find.
Help me, yeah. After September 11th, you know, people leaving these pictures and mm-hmm. letters and notes in Manhattan, because you don't know where your family member is. You don't know if that person made it out. And so people paid money to have these ads run in newspapers. These are very poor people. They're just emerging from slavery. Some offered rewards. Not many did, but some did. And when you read, you know, it's a husband looking for his wife and his children. It's a wife looking for her husband. It's a sister looking for her siblings. One man was just looking for any friends, anybody who might know him, because he's been displaced. He's been sold and sold and sold. And so just really powerful. And some people, a woman named Outlaw from, she was at that time in Raleigh, North Carolina, and she named about 12 children. So she had lost that many children. And she had all the names of the children, and she just wanted to hear something from one of them. You see also evidence that some people had managed to keep in touch for a while, had heard word, maybe an enslaved person who worked for a slave trader came back up that route and told them, you know, we dropped that person off in New Orleans. And so in some of the ads, you'll see, I remember one where it said her daughter had been sold, I think, from Virginia and had been taken to this place and then had been taken to Cuba and then to Texas. And then the trail went cold. And so at this point, she's just trying to say, you may have seen her in one of these places. Can you tell me any information you have? Slavery ended in 1865. The separations had taken place before that. But I see these ads in the newspapers until 1903. So people were still holding on to hope that they could find family members. You know, I guess they figured, I'm still alive. Maybe that person's still alive.
And do you have any evidence of people who found family members?
From the ads, I have one notice. It was in a church paper from Dallas, I think, saying that somebody had placed an ad in the paper and had just announced in church that she had found a relative. But when I went to find the original ad, I couldn't find it. Okay, so that was one example. Outside of the ads and through all kinds of circumstances, I did see people who found each other. Sometimes people just walked back to the place where they had last seen family and the people were still there. Sometimes they weren't there. Sometimes somebody recognized, do you have a brother in Cleveland? Well, I don't know. I used to have a brother, but I don't know where he is because we were sold apart. And then through a series of messages and interventions, they were able to find each other. But they were now adults and they hadn't seen each other since they were children. And it was one of the brothers had lost a finger at some point, and that was the marker, you know, that let them know this is indeed your brother. Some people did find each other. And when they did, then there could be all kinds of complications. So if you had been married and you're still looking for your wife or for your husband, you find the person, but the person's now married to somebody else, or children didn't recognize the parents because, well, they just didn't remember them. Or a mother is looking in her head. She had always been looking and thinking about her 8-year-old, but now that 8-year-old is a 25-year-old. And so how will you recognize each other? And once you do, so much has changed. You know, a child has now been raised by somebody else, and the mother may have different kinds of expectations of behavior. And so it could be quite complicated. Unfortunately, I don't get many details about what life was like. So they tell you about the big moment of reunification, but then they don't tell you the daily adjustments that had to take place.
This is a story that has a lot of dangling ends, really open-ended history. And I mean, in a way, all of us as historians are always writing stories that aren't really finished because the documents don't tell us everything we want to know. But this is such an open-ended history. I wonder if that made it harder for you to write or more interesting, or if you thought about that while you were writing it.
Yeah, it makes it very interesting, sometimes frustrating because, you know, I get bits and pieces, I get fragments. Somebody enters the record, the historical record for a moment, and then I can't find any trace of that person. And so I have to put several stories together, but I can't tell you how this person's story was resolved. I was talking with some people earlier about fiction, historical fiction, and history, and what some of the differences are. And one of the things that I thought about was that with fiction, you create your story and you can tie up of loose ends. You can tell me what happened, that, oh, this husband's been looking for his wife for 20 years. They find each other and then they realize they don't like. You can tell a story. Mm-hmm. But as a historian, it can be frustrating, but it's also maybe, it's certainly more realistic that we don't always know what happens. And we go poking around in the past, but we never know everything. We Right. know what some documents present to us. Even if you're writing about somebody like Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, for whom there are reams and reams of documents, there's so much that you can never know. So much that they didn't write down. So much that they were feeling that they never said, or that they, you know, we all have behaviors that we can't explain. We don't know. And so you going into the past, you can never know everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it's tempting to want to, and it's tempting to pretend that you do, but certainly doing this kind of work, you're just very aware that you never can. I can never speak for all Black people. I can never speak for all white people. I can never tell you everything about everybody. And even with one particular individual, I'm aware that there's just a lot I don't have access to. And mostly I'm okay with that, but sometimes it's sad. You know, you wish you had more of a person's story, and you just don't.
You also write about how when you go around talking about this, your work, that people tell you that it sounds like things that they're familiar with. As a Russian historian, the first thing I thought of was after World War II, and up until today, on Victory Day, you still hear on the radio people still looking for each other decades and decades later.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Native American children who are separated from their families and Nazi Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about the differences between those situations and slavery. Is there something different about the situation of North American slavery and the kinds of separations that took place, or kinds of searching that people did, or the kind of regime that it was? Are there things about this story that differentiate it from those? Or do you see it as a universal?
Well, I see forced separations as universal. You've named some of the contexts. But I see probably each of the circumstances is different. And so certainly, say, with Nazi Germany, I've been told that in Israel, there was a radio program for many decades where people were looking for family members. And those separations happened within a particular time period, right? With this, it happened in a particular time period, but over a very long period of time. And so people who were searching after the war were searching for people whom they'd lost in their lifetimes, but their parents may have lost people. You know, their parents may have been sold from one place to another. So it was something that was repeating in families, but also just maybe not in your particular family, but it was part of an experience of these people throughout slavery, escalating in the antebellum period, so the period of, say, the 40 or 50 years before the Civil War and the end of slavery. So I think it's something that people in some ways had to adjust to. I think that that's one of the things about us as humans, is that we adjust to all kinds of horrible things. And so people would be sent somewhere, and the assumption was that they would remarry, for instance. Your husband is essentially dead. You may not even know where he is. You think you left him somewhere, but is he still there? And you see people tussling with that. There's a man whose wife had been sent to another part of the state, miles and miles away, taken by her owners. He belonged to somebody else. His mistress, so his owner's wife, was writing letters for him. And he said, this is probably the last letter, because master says, it's only painful for you and painful for me to have these letters going back and forth, but it's not going to help anything. He's not going to send me there to live. So I'm trying to get your owner to send you back here with the children. He says, you know, master says, I should just find another person. And he says, you know, people tell me that many of these colored women who would be happy with me, but I'm not interested in them. And then he goes on, and then he says, yeah, and they tell me that I should just marry somebody else. And he says, but I'm not interested in them. But if I should ever do that, then I would let you know. And so you see him standing at this crossroads in his life. You know, what do I do? Am I ever going to see her again? Am I ever going to see my children again? And that is one of those rare, rare situations where I found that letter documenting the separation. And the separation actually took place in 1863. So it was during the Civil War. It was after the Emancipation Proclamation, but the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free most people. And so they were still owned by people. In 1870, the war ended 1865. In the 1870 census, I found him, Tate is his last name, in the census, living in a household with a woman. In the letter, he just said, my dear wife. He never called her name. But it's a woman who's about his age. And then he named his children. in the letter. He said, give my love to my children. He named them. And those children were also in the household. And so that's a place where I see reunification taking place. But the separation had occurred so close to the end of slavery. But at the time, he didn't know. She didn't know that slavery was going to be over. They didn't know who was going to win the war. So I think making these kinds of adjustments and deciding to go on living, for most people, some people, as I said, just fell apart and could not go on, went into a deep depression. I've seen descriptions of that. They didn't use that language, but what they describe, we would call depression. So, you know, it's hard to compare to these other situations, but I think the long-term nature of it is significant. Stories passed down in families about separations that had taken place before. And so I think that was part of what people knew could happen. So once you leave childhood, it just kind of loomed. So as a young child, you're not aware of what's going to happen, what could happen. And as I said, separation did not occur for everybody, but it was always a possibility because they did not control what would happen.
Yeah, you've really given us a good sense of how pervasive the threat of separation was and how much it was woven into the culture of the experience of enslaved people. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For a transcript of this episode, images, and links to more information, visit our website at 15minutehistory.org. That's the numerals 15minutehistory.org. You can access our full catalog of episodes free of charge at our website and through the iTunes U app for iOS or the Tunes Viewer app for Android. You can also access the 10 most recent episodes through the Apple Podcasts app, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, and Overcast. 15-Minute History is produced in partnership between Not Even Past and the Hemisphere's Outreach Consortium. Our executive editor is Joe Neuberger, and our technical editor is Christopher Rose. Our audio engineers are the awesome folks in the Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services, Jacob Weiss, Morgan Honecker, Will Kurtzner, Samantha Skinner, and Michael Heidenreich. Special thanks also to Michael DeLeon, iTunes U site administrator with Project 2021 and Educational Innovation. The University of Texas at Austin is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in episodes of 15-Minute History do not represent the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.